If a small flock of cartoon bluebirds didn't help you get dressed this morning, that just means you haven't yet listened to Fine Tuning with Jim Hill and Drew Taylor. No, the black dress slacks, please. Thank you. And now, Jim Hill.
Welcome to Fine Tuning with Drew Taylor, your one-stop shop when it comes to animation news and commentary. I'm Drew's co-host, entertainment writer Jim Hill, and CinemaCon is getting underway right now in Las Vegas.
Yeah, neither of us are in Vegas. What's up with that, Jim? We should be there.
I know. In fact, especially these days with this show, because just before we get started here, they tweeted out that they had Kelly Clarkson on stage at Caesars. She was there promoting the Ugly Doll movie, which comes out May 3rd of this year. I've done CinemaCon previously, and seriously, we do have to go to the show because it is unlike any of these, you know, WonderCons or CinemaCons or that sort of thing. It's not for fans. It's strictly a show for hardcore show business type, for exhibitors. I mean, did I ever tell you about, I went to the 2010 edition and they showed Toy Story 3 there?
No, I don't think you ever told me that.
It was so bizarre. I mean, you're literally in the whitest audience you've ever been in your entire life. It was entirely male. They all looked like me. They were little, old, bald, fat men who, you know, just very sort of begrudgedly had gotten up at like 8 o'clock in the morning, and they're in Vegas, and they got to be in, you know, the Caesars Coliseum at 10 o'clock in the morning to see this stupid Pixar movie, and, you know, lots of grumbling. But again, they're in there, and these guys are basically there because they want to find out whether or not this show is going to be really popular, which means they'll sell a lot of popcorn and Coke at their theaters. That's literally all this crowd cares about. Are they going to show up and are they going to buy popcorn? Because the margins on popcorn and soda are obscene, folks. You know, again, you buy that $12 bucket of popcorn, which is what? 5 cents worth of popcorn seeds and what? 10 cents of fake butter and a dollop of oil. I mean, that's where the real money is, folks. Right. All right, so anyway, Toy Story 3 starts to unspool. As the movie ends and Andy is driving away to go to college, and the lights suddenly come up because there are no credits. And, you know, this entire audience of big, tough cinema guys are weeping openly. But the lights came up too quickly, and everybody has to man up like, yeah, that's going to sell a lot of popcorn. That's going to sell a lot of soda. But speaking of the Toy Story movies, we're recording this on a Tuesday because you're leaving for Emeryville tomorrow, right? Or
yeah, I'm going up for the long lead day for Toy Story 4. So I think we're probably going to see maybe 30 minutes of the movie. Yeah, I get to talk to a bunch of the filmmakers, and I'm excited.
For a lot of people, the term long lead might be a little confusing. I mean, that's really something that sort of dates back to, what, the heydays of magazines and newspapers, right? Literally, they needed more time to prep their stories, right?
Yes, exactly. And the only time you really get long lead days anymore for movies is for animated movies. Because, you know, they've accomplished a certain amount. You sort of get broken into groups and you kind of go through the process. I mean, you've done a number of these where it'll be like story and then like character design and, you know, whatever. Mm-hmm. So you get sort of broken out in these pods and go through the whole movie.
Mm-hmm.
Which is really exciting, and it's sometimes very illuminating, because remember how the Zootopia long lead day happened like 2 weeks after D23? And the version of that scene that they showed of Judy and Nick interacting was completely different than the one they showed just a couple of weeks ago at D23?
That's right!
It's sort of fascinating in that way.
The other thing, I mean, well, especially when you do it at Pixar, I remember when I was up there for The Good Dinosaur, and like you said, they only show you like a half hour of the movie, and then you have to sort of, you do your walk-arounds, you talk with the directors, you do the character design folks and all that, but you're up on the second floor of Emeryville, and I remember I was waiting to go into a room, and they've decorated the outside hallway with concept art, and they had images up from the finale of Good Dinosaur, where Spot meets the other cavemen.
Oh, wow.
So I next go in and I'm sitting down and talking with Peter, the director. And so it's like, and asked about the end of the movie. And he looked at me like, who talked to you? You know, how did you learn this great state secret? And just say, you mean the piece of art that's out on the wall here next to the door?
Yeah.
And it's like, oh, we should have probably taken that down.
Yeah. You know, actually that now that you say that, I remember that at Incredibles 2, they had images of that boat from the climax.
Did they
out
really?
There. And they oh. didn't, they, yeah, and they never mentioned it during it. Yeah.
Okay. Now, these days, though, when we see the press stuff, don't they also, for animated films, do they still do the press day before the official premiere red carpet thing, or is that really more of a live action thing now?
No, yeah, they still do that. I mean, I'm sure this will be one of a number of times that I go to Pixar for Toy Story 4 related things. I think I was up there 3 times for Incredibles 2. So, and then there'll be the home video day, and you know,
of course.
I think it helps that Pixar is such a great place to go and hang out and, you know, walk around and spend a couple of days. So, yeah, I'm very excited.
What's the farthest out you've ever done a set visit? Last year, you were on the set of Nutcracker, what, 18 months out from release, or?
Yeah. I mean, I was on the set of Dumbo in September of 2017. So that tells you how far out some of these things are. And the funny thing with Nutcracker is that apparently the movie changed so much since the time that we went to the set that they never asked us to actually run our coverage. So I just got a free trip to London out of it. So, you know, that works.
Doubling back on Dumbo, which it's obviously had an interesting opening weekend. What was it like to be on the set for that? Because Burton's conceit of, I don't want any real live animals on the set of my circus movie. What was the workaround?
Yeah, I mean, it was interesting. The sets were incredible. And it was basically more of like a technical thing, like, you get to talk to Colleen Atwood and you get to talk to Rick Heinrichs and you get to see some of the sets, but we didn't get to go to the big set of Dreamland. Did you watch the movie this weekend, right?
Yeah.
And?
The very things you just mentioned, you know, Colleen Atwood's costumes were amazing and his design was, you know, Rick's design was stunning and I still cannot get past the how the hell did anybody at Disney corporate sign off on the Dreamland idea? Michael Keaton is basically the evil Walt Disney. I mean, who signed off on that story idea? 2 hours plus. I'm now starting to get a little concerned based on this box office about what happens next with Aladdin and Lion King. I have to assume that on the back of Will Smith that, you know, Aladdin will have a good, strong opening weekend, and depending on word of mouth, that sort of thing. And you have to assume with Lion King, they're going to play this up as, this is Jon Favreau. This is the guy who did, you know, the amazing Jungle Book. And you have to see it. It's the Lion King.
Yeah.
But
I think the other thing is that there are so many more ticket buying aged people who have a connection with Aladdin and Lion King rather than Dumbo, which is a movie from the 40s that, you know, made Harry Truman cry, but maybe does not have quite the same connection with Gen Z.
That's a very interesting observation. And though, speaking of movies that, you know, we wish that had sold more tickets as well, Mary Poppins Returns. And we actually had some news this week in regard to the folks who did the animation for that, Duncan Studios.
Yeah, well, this is a great studio in Pasadena, and I'm sure everyone will know their work because, you know, we talked about they did the animation for the Despicable Me attraction at Universal Studios. They did those extra scenes in the Iron Giant remastered version where it's like, what is it, his dream, the giant's dream?
Oh, yeah.
Ken Stewart Duncan, who's the guy that runs Duncan Studios, has worked on so many amazing movies. He was working at Real FX for a while, but obviously before that he was at Disney. He was the supervising animator for Meg and Hercules and Jane and Tarzan. He was an additional animator for Lion King and Aladdin. So, I mean, this guy has the chops. I mean, going all the way back to Land Before Time and All Dogs Go to Heaven, which we're going to talk about Don Bluth a little bit later in the show. But yeah, what did you think about the new projects that they had sort of announced with this deal?
I love that they're becoming a content provider rather than sort of a gun for hire. And just the idea that we're going to get Duncan Originals. My question then becomes, what are we talking for platforms here? I mean, where is it supposedly coming out?
Yeah, that's interesting, because one of the things that they announced was this thing called Nature's End, which they described as a fantasy slash science fiction adventure with an ecological ticking clock and a strong female hero that would combine live action, animation, and gaming. So I don't really understand that.
Okay, so that's peanut butter, chocolate, and Drano. It's like, wait a minute, a film that combines live action, animation, and gaming, because... Does that mean at some point I pull out a console while the movie's on and I help determine right. the end of it? That's the joy of working off of press releases, folks. It's sort of like, what the hell does that mean? We also have R.E.D., the anthology series. It's going to be inspired by pop novels of the 1950s. That actually sounds like a lot of fun as well. But I guess, again, on the back of the masterful work of the Royal Dalton Bowl sequence from Mary Poppins Returns. I can't wait to see what these guys do.
Yeah. Oh, you know what else they did that I wanted to bring up? Did you ever see Detroit, the Catherine Bigelow movie from a couple years ago?
I remember
not the most cheery movie, but if it comes on TV, they did this opening sequence that kind of like dramatizes like white flight and all of these issues that were affecting the inner city, sort of mid-century America. Mm-hmm. And it is amazing the way that they did this animation. It's really, really cool. So next time that pops up on cable, just watch it for that opening sequence that they did, because it is incredible. And I just wanted to give that a shout out before I forgot.
Definitely check that out. And as Drew mentioned, again, if you drill down into Ken's resume, the first couple of films that he worked on are Blue projects, Land Before Time, All Dogs Go to Heaven, Rockadoodle. Oh, my God. Which brings us back to Don Bluth and actually his history with the Disney Company, which Drew and I will discuss when we get back from this break.
It's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
Drew, I'm always fascinated by when it comes to entertainment history and things that might have been. And in a weird sort of way, I guess we wouldn't be where we are today animation-wise if Don Bluth hadn't actually resigned from Walt Disney Studios back in September of 1979. And it wasn't so much that Bluth left Disney, it's the fact that the very next day, 11 other animators left to join him. He was setting up his own production company, Aurora Productions, and there was a gentleman who had previously worked at Disney who had found funding, I want to say $6 million, and persuaded Don that, like, come and make your own hand-drawn film. I've got the rights to this Ms. Frisbee and the Rats of Nim. But the thing is, when Don went out the door and took those artists with him, that was 15% of the entire staff of Disney Animation at that point.
Yeah. There's that famous photo of all of them where they've got all their shit in the car and they're about to leave.
There we go.
It's crazy. Yeah.
And this didn't have to happen. I mean, Bluth had been unhappy for a number of years at Disney, but that was largely because Disney always talks about the nine old men and the hand-drawn tradition that was handed down, and Eric Larson trained everybody and so on and so forth. But the hard reality was that there was this group just below the nine old men that was just spoiling to sort of take over. They talk about Wooly Reitherman was originally directing The Fox and the Hound. And finally, Rich Richard, it was like, look, he's blocking us. We're making a bad movie because of Wooly. You got to get him out of here. And Disney had just started up its training program. So you had the Glenn Keens and the John Lasseters coming through the door, and they were actually the level below that. And so, you know, there was this kind of weird pressure cooker thing going on. And so Don was actually, because he felt like these guys at Disney are stifling us, that you know, there's the famous stories about Robin Hood and the amount of recycled footage that showed up in the 1973 movie. And a lot of that was Wooly Reitherman, like, you guys don't know how to animate the type of dance I need to do here. We're going to borrow footage from Snow White. You know, we're going to go take stuff from the Jungle Book. And it was really kind of an insulting thing to say to a younger animator that you can't do this scene. I'm going to go trace it from something we did in the 30s and the 40s. And so Don began to do this in 1975, began to do this project at home called Banjo the Woodpile Cat. And what happened is more and more animators learned about this. They would go to Don's house on the weekend and they'd work on this thing with him. And they were deliberately loading this thing up with all of these effects that Disney used to do in like films of the 30s and the 40s. So they were the stuff that they weren't learning at work, they were learning in Don's garage. After they got it in a semi sort of decent shape, Don takes it to Ron Miller. And he's like, hey, we're doing this as an outside project. And what do you think? Because if you really like it, you know, I know we're getting back in the featurettes business, because at that time, he's directing the small one, that right. Holiday special thing. And it's like, hey, what if we did this as the holiday special to Banjo the Woodpile Cat, to the holiday special that followed the small one? Because I know you're already talking about looking for a follow-up project. You're looking at that Mickey's Christmas Carol LP and seeing whether or not, you know, we can maybe turn that into a featurette. And Ron Miller said, no, I don't think it's Disney quality. I don't think it's quite up to our standards. And it was the exact wrong thing to say at that moment. That's what sort of put Don on the path to leave the company and to take all those animators with him. And you know, if you talk with anybody who worked at Disney during that period from like 79 to, I want to say it was as late as when Beauty and the Beast came out in 91, that they were constantly looking over their shoulder and battling with Bluth, because it was just sort of like, especially when, you know, George Lucas and Steven Spielberg suddenly, you know, it's like, hey, we're partnering with Bluth to do American Tale, or we're partnering with Bluth to do Land Before Time. That was a tough 10 years that honestly didn't have to happen. All Ron Miller would have had to have done was say, you're right, that would be a good holiday special. Sure, let's bring that in. I mean, and this situation always makes me think of what happened 25 years ago with Jeffrey Katzenberg, when Eisner basically forced him to resign because Jeffrey wanted Frank Wells' old job. I mean, there's this great line from the New York Times in regard to when Jeffrey resigned. It's like, Jeffrey needs to run his own store. Yeah, Michael, and he did. Maybe, 8 weeks later, he and Spielberg and Geffen get together and launch DreamWorks SKG, and then proceeded to poach, you know, how many veteran Disney staffers to come over and work for DreamWorks?
Yeah.
And what that did to animation salaries and how that changed the whole dynamic in the industry. I mean, all Eisner would have had to do to totally make that go away was turn to Jeffrey and go, look, I know you're not happy, but you want a certain level of control. So how about this? We just cut a production deal with Tim Burton to make Nightmare Before Christmas. We've signed that deal with the Pixar people to do their own animated features. They got a 3-picture deal. Why don't you go set up your own animation studio and we'll release your films? All you would have to do is set up give Jeffrey his own production house at Disney, and this all would have gone away.
Yeah.
I mean, I get it. Hindsight is 20/20, but when you think about what happened after that, when you think about the seismic events that DreamWorks and Pixar and Disney battling set up, and the careers that were destroyed, or what happened to hand-drawn.
Right.
Anyway, getting back to what we were talking about just last week, Disney Toon Studios, among the folks who worked at Disney Toon Studios back in the day was Chris Butler, the director of Laika's brand new Missing Link. That's the name, right?
Yeah, it's great. I think you're going to love it. It's really, really good.
Now, you just did this wonderful interview with Chris, and we'll get to that in a minute, but you spent time in Connecticut growing up, okay? So
that's
the thing I think that people really don't get about how wonderful Paranorman is, because when you wander around Connecticut, you run into those towns that are coasting on a historical event that happened 200 or 300 years ago. I mean, they're still selling the merch, so to speak, and the postcards, and here's the reenactment site and that sort of thing. And that's what I love about Paranorman is that he nailed Salem, Massachusetts. That is exactly what Salem is like. In fact, my Aunt Lorna lives one town over from Salem in Weymouth, Massachusetts. And I got to interview Chris back in the day, and he admitted that they were looking for sort of a tired old neighborhood. In fact, that scene where Norman is walking down the street and you first get to see him experiencing all the ghosts in the neighborhood and that sort of thing. And I'm watching the movie out in L.A. at a press screening, and I kind of freak out because it's like, that's the street that my aunt lives on. And I got to speak with Chris after the fact and asked him about it. And he's like, oh, God, yeah. Well, we drove around looking for tired neighborhoods. And there was this perfect one where we took all of these pictures. And it's weird still to this day to watch that movie. And that's like, my aunt lives in that house and there's a ghost out front.
I love that.
But again, he wrote Kubo and the Two Strings, which is masterful. And now he's writing and directing The Missing Link, which is really one of perhaps the most ambitious Laika to date.
Yeah, it sounds like it. I think it took over 2 years to photograph dozens of characters. It takes place in Victorian England, but then it comes to America. So you have like the kind of Victorian stuff and the Old West stuff. Mm-hmm. It's pretty amazing.
How did you sort of end up at Laika, and how did you end up in stop motion? Was that something that you had always wanted to do?
Not exactly.
Okay.
I started out wanting to be a 2D animator. I am really old, so I grew up in a time when 2D animation was pretty much all you got. Certainly no CG. So I always wanted to do drawn animation. I was kind of obsessed with Disney back then. And then this was at a time when the animation industry was maybe not at its best. Mm-hmm. There wasn't a huge amount of stuff going on, certainly not in England. There was a lot of commercial work, but certainly no feature work. I think animation has enjoyed such a vibrant renaissance over the last 15 years, you know, and that was not the case back then. So you took what work you could, and I remember hearing that Tim Burton was going to make another stop-motion movie in London, Corpse Bride. So I was storyboarding back then, and I thought, I am going to work on this. And I kind of dabbled in stop-motion on and off, but not in this way. And you know, I always talk about how inspirational it was to me as a filmmaker, because when you're storyboarding or trying to think up a shot or how you're cutting from one thing to another, you're just trying to think dynamically about how to frame part of a scene. Really, it's just in your head. But with this, I got to walk down onto the set and I could be in the place that the story is happening. And I could imagine, well, if I put the camera here, if I put the camera here, if I move the puppet here. And it started to make me really think about filmmaking in a way that I hadn't done before. As a story artist, I was really just thinking about gags and funny drawings. But this made me think about cutting and continuity and framing and composition way more than I had done before. And so I was sold. I think after that, I loved that experience, and I just wanted to work more and more in stop motion. And I got the opportunity to work on Coraline. I'd heard about Coraline was going to start up. It was at Laika in Portland. I didn't know much more than that, other than I wanted to work with Henry Selick, and this was an opportunity. So I came out to Portland. I didn't even come out for an interview or check the place out. I just packed my bag and left. And I think I agreed to come for 6 months, and that was 13 years ago, so something worked out.
Yeah, well, I was going to say, you are sort of the, like, kind of creative continuity through all of the, like, features, but you didn't work on Box Trolls. I guess that is the outlier.
I didn't. I did give notes at some point, I think. You know, there's always stuff going on at the studio that you kind of pop in and out of, but there's a spirit of collaboration, I think, but I didn't officially work on that one, no.
Well, you co-directed the second feature, which is, you know, Paranorman, one of the great animated films, I think, of the modern era. But you've always... It's true. I just rewatched it recently. So, but you've worked on scripts and storyboarded, and so what is it about Laika and that process that makes you just kind of, like, go into it sort of wholeheartedly, no matter the project?
My situation at Laika is unique. I never expected for that to happen. Seldom do you get the opportunity as an artist to do what you want, and as a storyteller to tell exactly the story that you want to tell and not have a million different hands grab onto it and try to make it into something else. I got that opportunity at Laika. I showed part of the script for Paranorman to Travis, and he said, I want to make this movie. I want you to direct it. And of course I did with Sam Fell. But at no point did it feel like it needed to evolve into something else. It was like, I love this, and we're going to make this.
Mm-hmm.
And that's just unheard of. No one these days gets that opportunity. And I've had it twice.
Right.
After Paranorman finished, I did work on Kubo, but Travis said to me, you know, what do you want to do next? And I had, like, again, just like this grab bag of ideas that I've worked on and off for a long time, and I, you know, pulled one out, dusted it down, and said, what do you think about this? And that became Missing Link. So I am spoiled when it comes to creativity, and I think that's why I'm there. There is a refreshing perspective at the studio which says the creator really is the creator. It can be one person's vision, and that can become a great animated movie.
It's amazing that you've had two movies that you've gotten to write and either direct or co-direct, because I feel like that is sort of an unprecedented thing in animation.
Yeah,
besides Brad, you know, getting his Incredibles movies done that way.
Sure.
So how fully formed was Missing Link? Because it seems like the production was pretty quick, right?
No.
No. Okay.
No, not at all.
Okay.
In fact, I think it's our longest production.
It's really?
Total. Yeah. I mean, the development part was very brief, and I think that's because the story was already quite well formed. So it was in development for about a year. That's when I was kind of working on the script and starting, you know, initial concept work. Pre-production, when you really get into the design and the building of the assets, that was about a year as well. So that part of it, all very quick. The shooting itself was 2 years.
Wow.
And that's pretty long because it was such an ambitious project. Most number of sets we've ever had, and an incredible amount of location changes and background characters. So it was a hugely complex undertaking. The story itself, I pretty much knew what it was. So it didn't go through a lot of rewrites, really. Maybe 2-3 drafts total. And I think that's because I've been working on it for a long time before I showed it to Travis. And I think the other thing is, if you're the writer and the director, it's kind of easier in a way because you're writing exactly what you want to see on the screen.
Right. What was the sort of initial hook for you? Was it doing a movie about the Yeti and the Bigfoot? Was it... I mean, it seems like you were very interested in the Victorian period, and I loved how you could kind of get the kind of, like, classic Victorian and the Old West in the same movie. What was the real hook for you?
So, a long time ago, my favorite movie of all time is Raiders of the Lost Ark.
Okay.
And I thought, wouldn't it be great if I could do, like, a stop-motion Indiana Jones kind of story? So, that was the initial hook, I think. Interestingly enough, I came up with the character of Lionel Frost, and I thought of him as a combination of Sherlock Holmes and Indiana Jones. Obviously, the time period and the eccentricity, the borderline sociopathy, that's more Sherlock Holmes, but the action-adventure hero, that's the indie. But the original story that I came up with, there was no Mr. Link. It was a different kind of creature.
Oh, really?
Yeah, and I came up with this story, and it was I was really happy with the story. And at the same time, other ideas were sparking, so I wrote another adventure for the same character, and this was the one with Mr. Link.
Okay.
And it became clear very, very quickly that the greatest hook for any of this adventure was that character. He just immediately became the heart of it. So I discarded that first story and concentrated on the second one, in fact, and it became very much a story about Link rather than an adventurer.
Well, I was going to ask about the look of the movie, too, and it's very interesting that you have a furry character as the main character, but you didn't go the kind of, Rankin Bass, like, boil, yeah. Even though there was no boiling, it's all very designed. Can you talk about that decision and why you went with that look?
It was a couple of things, actually. I'm by no means a stop-motion purist.
Mm-hmm.
I love all the different looks that you can achieve with stop-motion. So I love when Wes Anderson makes a stop-motion movie. But it's not what I wanted to do. Mm-hmm. I wanted to have my own look, and I wanted to take full advantage of all the innovations that we've been exploring for the last four movies. And I also wanted to stylize it in a way that was pretty aggressive, you know?
Mm-hmm.
I wanted this movie to be big, bold, colorful, and playful. And part of that was this graphic stylization, this angularity, and that came from, these initial character designs that I did. I think because the look of it was so stylized, it became clear very quickly that the hair on the characters would need to be similarly stylized.
Okay.
I wanted Link's fur to look like it was the same material that's on the top of the characters' heads.
Right.
So having real fur would have just looked like it was a different movie.
Right.
And in a way, it allowed us to explore his construction in a way that was unique. I mean, he is a unique creation. He was incredibly challenging as a puppet build because of all that hair.
Mm-hmm.
And the way we approached it in the end was almost like scales. So these little tufts can ride over the top of each other, and you can achieve a lot of elasticity without having all the silicone bunch up. So it was challenging. But I think what we got exists in this world incredibly well. He fits, mm-hmm. and he looks pretty cool as well.
It seemed to me, and you can correct me, but there seemed to be more kind of CGI extras in this movie than in any other Laika movie. Is that true, or was the majority of it puppet? And were those CGI sort of fixes helpful in kind of wrestling this thing to the ground?
I don't think we would have been able to make it without CG extras.
Right.
Certainly wouldn't, because you could never animate that many puppets in a crowd.
Right.
So, yes, an awful lot of CG. And that's the thing. If you're making a travelogue, if you're making Around the World in 80 Days, and you're going to 10 different countries, those countries have to be populated. Otherwise, it's a different kind of movie.
Right.
So I knew that was going to be a challenge. I think the VFX group had done astonishing things with our CG characters over the years, and I was so impressed with what they did here, because it's a pet peeve of mine when you see an animated movie where the background characters look different from the foreground characters. They look less thought out or more identikit, and I didn't want that. So we came up with a pretty complex system that allowed us to visit these very different places and have very different looks, very different costumes, very different facial hair everywhere we went. And it's pretty hard to pick out a repeat
mm-hmm.
in all these scenes. So I was thrilled with what we came up with. Yes, there's a lot of puppets as well, though. I certainly don't want to take away from the puppets department, because they had their work more than cut out. Yeah, I think you also have to be very careful about how you shoot these things.
Mm-hmm.
So, like, I had a scene in New York docks, and I didn't want us to have to build an entirety of New York docks, because it was for a handful of shots. So we were very careful about how we compose those shots that immediately say you are about to embark on a journey, a sea journey. But you're doing it in a very thoughtful, montage-like way that checks all the boxes that make you think you're in a much bigger place.
My last question is, obviously, do you know what you're doing next? Are you working on something? Are you going to stay in stop motion, or have you, like Travis, been seduced by, you know, the live action world? What's next on the Chris Butler to-do list?
I've not been seduced by anything, not in a long time. I haven't really thought about it, to be honest. My head's still very much in this movie, because we only finished it a couple of weeks ago, and now we're in the middle of the, we just started the publicity thing. So all I can think about right now is a vacation would be nice. I would actually like to do some writing. I think that's probably one of my favorite parts of the process. And, you know, we have a crew of 450 people. You're around a lot of people a lot of the time. The writing part means I can go and disappear in a hotel room somewhere and just, you know, disappear into a fantasy world. Right. So I think I'd like to do some writing next, but vacation first.
Well, thank you so much for chatting with me, Chris. I love this movie, and I'm such a huge fan of all of your work, so it was a real thrill to get to chat with you.
Thank you.
All right, have a great day.
You too.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
What's wonderful about listening to Chris describe his process is that story where he talks about how the New York dock scene and the whole notion of, I don't want to build the whole New York dock. I need that sort of montage that shows them arriving, but I don't want to build this giant set. But a gifted filmmaker can figure out, I need this, this, and this, this for this shot. That just reminded me, there's this great story about Robert Stevenson. He's the guy who directed the original Mary Poppins and a lot of Disney's special effects comedies from the 60s and 70s, like The Love Bug and that sort of thing. But there's this great story about they're working on The Island at the Top of the World, which was Disney's big release for the holiday of 74. And Stevenson had been around the block so many times that when he's looking at, you know, the script for the film and realizes, okay, it's set in the Arctic and they're going to be running around rocks a lot. And he sits down with the production designer and they just basically designed this one giant rock that, you know, because Stevenson has done this so many times, it's like, okay, so this is where we shoot that scene with it. So when you're watching David Hartman in Island at the Top of the World, keep in mind that whenever he's running by a rock, it's the same damn rock, all right? It's just shot from a different angle or lit differently or that sort of thing. And only somebody who's made a lot of movies knows how to do that, can use that sort of economy or as you were describing, knows how to look through the lens of a camera and is, that's all I need. This is what I need to tell that story. I don't need a giant set.
Right.
I need this chunk. So I can't wait to see what this guy does next.
I know. He's the best.
I hope he gets to hole up in that hotel room very soon and whatever he's going to write, he writes next. And speaking of next, Drew, when are we next going to get another Light Diffuse?
We're going to get one this week. I think we're starting... all of April is devoted to Mission Impossible 3, so we're doing a three-part making of series, and then we've got a great interview with one of the camera technicians from Mission Impossible 3, who tells a lot of really funny, weird stories about being on the set for the domestic part of the shoot for Mission Impossible 3. So that's the rest of April is all Mission Impossible 3, baby.
Okay, and that's really when the series rebooted, right? Or...
Oh yeah. I mean, that's when JJ came on. That's when things really kind of got going in a big way. So yeah, I think it's an interesting story. I hope you like it.
You've kind of ruined Saturday and Sunday afternoons for me now, because whenever I'm grazing on television and I see it's a Mission Impossible movie, it's like, oh, now I got to watch it. Okay, because now I got to see the scene that Drew talked about, or you know that sort of thing. Anyway, so be sure and check that out, folks. Our side of the fence, we got Disney Dish with Len Testo. We got the Marvel Us Disney podcast with the amazing Aaron Adams. We have I Want That with Shelley Valladolid. We have Looking at Lucasfilm with the amazing Dan Z. And in fact, in theory, you and me and Dan will be in Chicago this time next week, right?
Yeah. Oh, my God.
And then finally, Universal Joint with Dustin Fuse. And if you could do Drew and myself a favor and head over to iTunes and rate and recommend our shows. Likewise, if you'd like to support what we're doing here, head over to Bandcamp and subscribe. We are working on some Bandcamp exclusive shows that I think you'll like. Thanks for listening, folks, and we'll be back soon.
Be sure to tune in again for another fine episode of Fine Tuning with Jim Hill and Drew Taylor.